We only have two simple rules, lots of bad language, and you can call all you want. Are you paying attention? No bad language and only one call per show. That's the rules. I wonder how many people just let that go by. Yeah. Hewlett-Packard is going to lay off, it appears, another 30,000 people. Wow. That's a big hit, probably in the number next month. 30,000 from Hewlett-Packard. What are they doing? Cost-cutting, certainly. But that's a lot of people, and that's many announcements now. Hungary has sealed off its border with Serbia with massive coils of barbed wire. I wonder if they're going to make Serbia pay for it. Anyway, they're detaining migrants trying to use the country as a gateway to Western Europe. I understand the fear that they're going through, and what it is they're afraid of Muslims, frankly. They don't know who's mixing in with these people because they're coming in such droves. There's no way to check them out. And I agree with that. I mean, you don't know what you're getting. But as a result, everybody is being treated poorly. These are not just, I mean, they probably are just poor people trying to get the hell out of the way of what's going on in Syria. But, you know, among their numbers, one story that I have to talk with you about today. Now, last month, I told you that there was big buzz going on about the month of September, right? And a few people looked it up and said, gee, I don't see anything. I don't see anything about September. Well, here it is. Now, what I'm about to read you came from the Before It's News site. It should be called Before It's Ever Going to Be News. Anyway, let me read you what I got. Dateline Vatican City. Now, this scared the hell out of me. Honestly, it did. During a sermon at St. Peter's Square on Sunday, this is not real news, folks. It's not. During a sermon at St. Peter's Square on Sunday, Pope Francis spoke of a forthcoming event in which the earth will be consumed by hellfire from above and asked Christians around the world to absolve themselves of sin in the days and weeks ahead. In a statement released by the Vatican Tuesday morning, Pope Francis, who is scheduled to arrive in the U.S. on September 22nd, announced that he's been visited on three occasions, get this, by heavenly beings who most recently have warned of an impending crisis that could have dire consequences for all life on Earth. The Pope is set to attend a meeting of the UN General Assembly on September 25th at the UN building in New York, where he'll confer with world leaders, including President Obama and Russian President Putin, to discuss defensive options. On Tuesday morning, NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg confirmed that he has made arrangements to attend the General Assembly. I spoke, he said, with the Holy See and told the Associated Press NATO is working closely with our counterparts around the globe to explore every viable recourse available. Now, if you usually, you know, Before It's News is pretty good, all right? It's of the sites that you look for paranormal stuff, it's one of the better ones. But why they ran this, I don't know. But I read it and read it again. It scared me, but good. You know, there are references to the Associated Press in here, which are partially true. But the Pope said no such thing. And one of the reasons we're getting calls from people who are packing up the car, packing up the wife and kids, and headed for Mount something or another is because of this. You know, we started thinking about it earlier today and looking for, you know, AP references and that sort of thing. Nothing on the AP. Then people who had heard the Pope deliver the speech and said, well, you know, he didn't say anything about that. That would have gotten your attention, right? Certainly got mine. So, before you pack up the wife and children, and before you buy into some story like this, for God's sakes, check it out. Really, check it out. I wonder if that's what's moving people. I suspect so. One of the best places to get a good look at a passing UFO would be an observatory, right? Where the main objective is to look at the night sky, naturally. A few people at the Griffin Observatory got a really good look at some great photos and video footage of two UFOs hovering and doing other very unplane-like movements in the sky above L.A. recently. What's really interesting about the sighting is that other people down in L.A. actually got to see it, giving it some nice corroboration. That was from theanomalous.com. Anyway, I'm really miffed. You know, this story stole about 45 minutes of my life today. Not only that, but I said, hey, hon, my Catholic wife read it. And she got really serious looking and said, well, I don't think I've committed any big sins. I better get to church. I had the weirdest dream last night. I had a dream about a UFO. How often does that occur? I was in a bus, and I had a camera, right? And I was going out of my mind because there was this plain to see UFO up ahead in my dream. And so I went to the front of the bus trying to get, you know, a decent picture of the thing, which was just ahead of us hovering. And I couldn't get a picture of it. And then finally I did, went around a corner. So I can't remember. It was in the dream, right? What do I know? I got a picture of the UFO, or a couple of pictures, and then, you're going to love this, somehow or another I got to the UFO, and some little green guy, he wasn't really green, but an alien of some kind, reached out, grabbed my camera, and took it in, and I beat on his saucer. I got on the saucer, and I beat the hell out of it, and out comes this arm with my camera, and I was happy. I remember in my dream being happy, and then, of course, I looked at my camera, and the two pictures of the UFO that I took were gone. Ooh, was I angry. So maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's kind of like real life, huh? The pictures are always gone. This one was really gone. All right, coming up in a moment, Lloyd Auerbach has a master's degree in parapsychology. He is the director of the Office of Paranormal Investigations, president of the Forever Family Foundation. Lloyd has been in the field for 35 years, focusing on education and field investigation. He is the author of 9 books, very prolific, including The Ghost Detective's Guide to Haunted San Francisco, his newest release, ESP Wars, we'll talk a bit about that tonight, East and West. This book covers the psychic spying program of the U.S. and Soviet Union, co-authored by Dr. Edwin C. May, who ran the U.S. program. So he should know, right? And Dr. Victor Rubel is available on Amazon.com and other online bookstores. So again, the name of the book is ESP Wars. Great name for a book, actually. He is also a professor, by the way, at Atlantic University, JFK University, teaches parapsychology through the HCH Institute in Lafayette, California, teaches online courses through the Rhine Education Center. He is on the board of directors of the Rhine Research Center and the Winbridge Institute. Lloyd's media appearances on TV, radio, and print number in the thousands, which include ESPN SportsCenter. That's an interesting one, isn't it? I wonder if they were looking for ESP with regard to coming sporting events. That would be wrong, right? ABC's The View, Oprah, and Larry King Live. He works as a parapsychologist, professional mentalist, public speaking, media skills coach, and is a professional chocolatier, to top it all off. That's putting the chocolate right on top, right? So coming up in a moment, well, Mark sent me a wormhole message and says, that was the funniest story slash dream I've heard in a great long while. Laughter for minutes. Really? You know, it didn't strike me that way. It was one of those really frustrating dreams. I guess it is funny when you think about it, pounding on a UFO, right? Little hand coming out, giving you your camera, and you're all happy, and you go down and check it, and of course, the pictures are gone. Anyway, I'm glad that somebody enjoyed it. Thank you, Mark. All right, Lloyd Auerbach, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Art.
It's good to have you. You're welcome to comment on anything I started out with and or not. And then we can go on to your book, ESP Wars, and we can find out what that's all about. First, if you want to comment, go ahead.
I did, as you know, I also looked to try to find a source of that and actually found a source earlier than before its news. And there were some marks, earmarks of that just didn't seem right, especially since none of the other news media was covering it. And even looking at the Vatican site, there was no press release on it.
I know. But if you, for example, let's see, where's the text? If you were to go to Google right now and put in something like Pope and what would be the word? Hellfire. Put in Pope, well, space, Hellfire.
Pope Francis and Hellfire.
And man, they're everywhere. They're everywhere. So it's no wonder they're packing up the cars out there.
Yeah, you know, there's an old saying in science fiction that was credited to Theodore Sturgeon, and that was 90% of all science fiction is crap, but then again, 90% of everything is crap.
Well, yeah. They ought to rename it before it's ever going to be news.
Yeah. It's so easy to put up, to construct these kinds of stories. I mean, some people actually believe that stories in the Weekly World News, if you remember that paper.
Yeah, but this is so important. I mean, my poor wife is Catholic. I'm telling you, she was counting sins earlier today, you know.
It's scary. It's scaremongering.
Yeah, it is. And I've fallen for a few things myself, but this one actually, for a little while, scared me. Because I was seeing it in so many places. Anyway.
I'd be curious to see, the Huffington Post every week does something. I think it's the Huffington Post does something about the false things. Or maybe it's the Washington Post about false things on the Internet this week. And they kind of cover the top five stories on the Internet that seem to be taken as real by something. And usually it's celebrities, but sometimes it's news-related stuff. I'd be kind of curious to see if they cover that one.
Yeah, but this was so serious. I mean, somebody would research this a little before they printed it, you would think.
You would think.
I mean, it's easy to get caught on little things, but, I mean, end-of-the-world stuff, you know, you need to look at that hard.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. In fact, I called Lloyd about this, and I said, hey, you know, we're going to be talking about this tonight, and you need to be prepared to comment on it, so that's why I called him. And he checked into it, and we both found out about the same time that it was hooey. Now watch, Lloyd, the world will end, and nobody around be around to say, I told you so.
Well, you know, it's like the idea of life after death, that those people who are, if there is no life after death, those of us, those people who do believe in life after death will never know that they're wrong. But the people, and if there is life after death, those people who do not believe in survival of death will be very surprised.
Let me tell you something. I said this the other night, and I really meant it. You know about the movie Flatliners, and then there was a recent TV series called Proof.
Very good show.
I thought it was pretty good, too. And you know, I said it should have been called No Proof until the last episode. And then, of course, that's when they really hit it.
Right.
But anyway, I'm sorry.
We have to talk about proof versus evidence, because proof is a very, you know, touchy thing. It's not always that easy to actually have hard proof on things.
Not at all. And I was watching that, and I told my wife, you know, at my age, if I was healthy and I thought I'd withstand it, I'd be willing to give a shot at flatlining.
Mm.
I want a good medical team. I want all the goodies they had there to make sure you come back. But I'd almost be willing to give it a try so I could know. That sound crazy?
Yeah, well, not necessarily, no. You know, people have done crazier things. You would know, but then everyone else would still not having had that experience.
Well, the hell with them.
Yeah.
I would know. That's what would matter. Sorry. I really would try it, though, and it begs the question of NDEs, period, and what people have experienced. I've got a story here from an atheist who claims he had an NDE for about 2 minutes and saw absolutely nothing. Black.
Well, there are other atheists who have had NDEs with the full-on experience of having a voice tell them to go back or seeing a relative or something else or seeing, you know, seeing the light. So, and then there, of course, there are the negative NDEs, which come from people typically who grew up in hellfire and brimstone religions, typically. So there is an influence. There certainly is. Not every NDE is the same, and there are 15 different constituents that kind of comprise a classic NDE, but they're not always there. And you can have a near-death experience that doesn't affect you, which wouldn't put it in the camp of parapsychology, more in the neuroscience camp.
Well, to actually flatline and get absolutely nothing, that would be worse than not coming away with the pictures of the UFO.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be really annoying. I would expect something. Right. A little brain activity as the cells begin to die, whatever, something.
Well, my question for that atheist was, it was just about atheism? Because you can be an atheist and believe in psychic phenomena and even believe in life after death. But if you're an atheist and you disbelieve in all this stuff, and the possibility of this, maybe you're programming yourself so that you don't have an experience.
Well, maybe you get exactly what you believe in.
Yeah.
I don't know. This whole thing was on Reddit, and it really was there. He apparently had two NDEs, and he says, yes, the truth is, both times, I was simply not there. It was just black. I'd describe it as when you take a nap. Well, I don't know about that. I dream. A short nap, no dream, he says. Ah, you wake up, and it feels like you've been sleeping a long time, when in reality it's only been about 15 minutes. So, you know, he got exactly, apparently, what he expected.
Well, and he got what a lot of people get, because it's only a small, you know, it's a smaller segment of people who have either flatlined or their hearts have stopped. Remember, it is a near-death experience, not a death experience, so not everyone has the experience.
Well, then, if it's not a death experience, how do we define death?
We're constantly redefining death.
What, no brainwaves, no heartbeat?
You can go no brainwaves, no heartbeat. And really, you have to, not just brainwaves, you have to talk about electrocortical activity in general. You know, the famous Pam Reynolds case, where the woman was undergoing some serious brain surgery, and they actually not only stopped her heart, but they brought her body temperature down, as you saw in the TV show Proof, but even more significantly than that, and there was literally no activity. It wasn't just flatline. This woman was dead.
Yeah.
As Dean Radin would say, she was triple dead.
Right.
They stopped her heart, stopped her brain, and she was just dead, dead, dead.
Right.
And she had the classic out-of-body experience. She came back remembering things that there's just no way her brain was reacting to, not only in the operating room, but also in areas right around. And none of that, you know, the skeptics would say that, well, obviously they told her about it as she was coming around, and there's no evidence that supports any of that.
I think I remember that was a 60-minute segment.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yeah, I think so.
And I believe I also, I have memory of interviewing her, but I interviewed so many people, and I have interviewed a number of people who have had incredible NDEs.
Yeah.
And seeing relatives and people, swarms of people, sometimes not so happy people. A bunch of them. So it is, I think, the biggest question for mankind, and that is whether this is it or there is yet more.
Yeah, and for most people, we'll find out when we die.
Yes, that's right. And if there's absolutely nothing, well, we won't complain.
Right. But there's a lot of evidence that there's much, you know, that human spirit or consciousness survives.
So you lean toward that direction.
Oh, absolutely. I the evidence is there. When you discuss this, I discuss this with some of my colleagues in parapsychology, and frankly, not everybody comes from a perspective you can call dualism or even pluralism, that consciousness is more than just the brain. people in my field, even though we're dealing with psychic ability, many people are more materialist and believe and don't believe in survival possibility at all. They think that ESP kind of covers all the experiences that we have that we would call evidence for life after death.
Now, that's what the search is all about.
Right.
Lloyd. So I know that touching on another area that would provide evidence of an afterlife or of something after would be ghosts. And
Yes. It's
yet another area. You're into all of these areas, and so you're like the perfect guy to ask about this. You have obviously investigated ghosts. Would you conclude, with all the investigating you've done, that they are that really are ghosts?
Yes. Well, first, let's define that.
With all right.
That ghost, we tend to use the word apparition in parapsychologists because ghost has a lot of pop culture charge around it. But the idea that we survive, that spirit consciousness, or you like to use the word consciousness, survives the death of the body. The brain dies, your body's dead. Your consciousness, for some people, sticks around and is capable of connecting with those of us that are alive, is capable of mentally connecting with our consciousness, kind of mind-to-mind, using basically ESP to do it, and even providing us with an image of what we might actually see, if we could actually see them, what they sound like. The personality of these people doesn't dramatically change at all after they've died, and it seems like it's not everyone that sticks around. In the thousands of reported experiences with apparitions or ghosts over the last 130-plus years in parapsychology and psychical research, the vast majority of them are people who see or experience a friend or loved one, a relative, who is at the moment of death or just after, sometimes within a couple of days, kind of the person's there to say goodbye, and then they never hear from them again. That's it. And then there's a small segment where sometimes the relatives come back once in a while, and there's a much smaller segment where the individuals stick around either a location or people for quite some time sometimes, and they communicate, and they may even figure out how to move things and make a nuisance of themselves sometimes. I've had cases, even my late co-author, Annette Martin, has made herself known that way to people.
Mm-hmm. How about this, Lloyd? Do some people stick around for a short amount of time and then go? I mean, I know the Buddhists believe this, for example. And I have some reason to believe it myself, that for a few days there's a very, very big presence that you can almost, you really can feel it.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. It seems to be on the average about 2 to 3 days. But
sounds about right to me.
Yeah, it can be a little bit longer for some people. I had a friend of mine, the late Martin Caden, who was a science and science fiction writer. When he passed away in 97, he was into all this stuff, and he actually was able to move things. He was psychokinetic himself under some very good control conditions. And he always kind of told me he was going to haunt me for a few days after his death. And then nothing happens for the first week. And a week and a half into it, I had an experience which I definitely said was him. And 10 minutes after my experience, one of his pilot buddies on the East Coast, I'm on the West Coast, had the exact same experience that I did in his Cessna while he was flying his plane. And it turned out another person had an experience 10 minutes later, and those two other pilot buddies of Martin Caden's, actually found a total with all together with all of us, 25 of us.
Wow.
Within like a day and a half. And so wherever he was that first week and a half, we don't know. He must have been bopping around the world saying goodbye to people, but we only know about the ones that were kind of in our circle, more or less.
The one place I really wouldn't want to have that experience would be in a Cessna, of all things. All right, hold on, Lloyd.
Dark Matter News, I'm Leo Ashcraft. Like a scene out of an end-of-the-world disaster movie, the town of Anderson Springs, California goes up in flames while being filmed by a fleeing YouTuber. The video, nearly 2 minutes in length, shows the utter devastation caused by the so-called Valley Fire, located in the county roughly 100 miles north of San Francisco, that has ravaged over 61,000 acres, destroyed at least 400 structures, and is currently only 5% contained. There has also been one reported death due to the fire as of late. Maddie Ross, a 25-year-old student at Santa Rosa Junior College who fled with her grandparents from their Hidden Valley lake home, said it looked like hell everywhere. She told the New York Times, "It was terrifying, truly terrifying. I've never been in a situation like that. We all felt like the world had come to an end." By Sunday afternoon, upwards of 1,000 homes and commercial structures had been damaged by what has been dubbed the Valley Fire. Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency for Lake and Napa counties due to the fire, and according to the Associated Press, 23,000 residents have been evacuated already. Daniel Berlant, a spokesman for CAL FIRE, claims firefighters in California have responded to nearly 6,800 wildfires, burning 545,000 acres with CAL FIRE alone, and they had handled 5,000 of the wildfires that had claimed 150,000 acres compared with 80,000 acres per year on average. But 20-mile-an-hour winds quickly pushed the blaze towards Middletown and the surrounding communities. A few hours later, half the town was destroyed. Gary Cross, a former fire chief and current Calagosta City Councilman, had this to say: "There is a sense of disbelief. It will be an absolute miracle if we don't start hearing about fatalities up there. You get heart attacks, accidents in cars, because this fire came through so quick." What are your thoughts? So many wildfires burning across America today. Are we seeing further signs of climate change? Let us know your thoughts at darkmatternews.com. Got news tips or other information you'd like to share? Hit the tip line at darkmatternews.com. And a welcome to another Dark Matter News staff writer, Pete Fernbaugh, brings us the following to consider. Is history a lot like the game of telephone in which stories are repeated over and over again until the final retelling bears little resemblance to the truth? This is what Sarah A. Christman and her husband Gabriel believe. In 2010, they made a life-changing decision. Frustrated with the complexities of daily life and fascinated by the secrets of the past, the Christmans, both of whom are history buffs, chose to time travel in a way, transporting their lifestyle back to the late Victorian era of the 1880s and 1890s. They began by purchasing a Victorian house in Port Townsend, Washington, which happens to be an historic Victorian seaport. Their first step after moving in was to get rid of the electric refrigerator and replace it with an icebox. From there, the Christmans purchased a mechanical clock that Sarah winds each morning. They installed oil lamps for lighting. For heat, the house features a 19th century gas heater and an antique kerosene space heater. The couple sleeps on an antique Victorian bed, which has a mattress that Sarah sewed by hand and stuffed with feathers for authenticity. For transportation, Gabriel rides a high-wheel bicycle and Sarah rides a high-wheel tricycle. Neither owns a cell phone and Sarah has never had a driver's license. Instead, they're quite content to live with their primary source materials, completely immersing themselves in the late 19th century. If you'd like to learn more about the Christmans, you can visit them at thisvictorianlife.com or head on over and read Pete's great article. I've only just touched on it. It's quite extensive at darkmatternews.com. I'm Leo Ashcraft, Dark Matter News.
Good evening, Bob, if you're out there listening. Back to Lloyd Auerbach. Lloyd, welcome back. So all of these things that you investigate and been investigating for now 30 years, including ESP, all of them actually either go to our abilities that are beyond the obvious and physical, or our everlasting, hopefully, soul.
Yeah, I mean, what we study in parapsychology can be looked at as relating to consciousness, whether you are a materialist believer, you know, basically that it's just the brain, it's still... You're saying that consciousness is resident in the brain, and that's where ESP and mind over matter happen to be. Or if you do have some acceptance or belief, or at least an awareness that it's possible that consciousness can survive the death of the body, can reach out beyond the body and beyond the brain. You know, we talk about extrasensory perception. It really is a form of perception, and it's only extrasensory in that it's extra or beyond what we consider the normal senses. And even that idea of what is considered a normal sense is changing, and as we learn more about humans and other animals, and even about how we can augment our senses.
All right. Where to go? You mentioned psychokinetic, right?
Yeah.
And you said that it has been demonstrated to you. And this is an area of intense interest for me. To be able to see anything moved with mental power would astound me, and I would immediately begin practicing, trying to do it myself. What is it that you have actually seen with your own eyes?
Well, I've seen a number of different things. If we can start with some of the cases that I've had,
sure.
There have been physical movements of objects where there was no obvious physical source. So in a couple of the ghost cases, for example, there's a restaurant out in east of San Francisco called the Banta Inn, and my first visits there in the 1980s, they had supposedly a ghost there who had been moving stuff around for people for some time after he died in the late 60s. And even on my first visit, the very first thing I saw, and we were shooting something for the old TV show Hard Copy, there was an ashtray on the bar next to the cameraman and the director who had their back to the bar as they were interviewing me. And this is in the morning. This is probably 11 in the morning. And the ashtray popped up into the air in full view of me and the bartender and the production assistant at the other end of the bar. They were at the other end of the bar. It flipped over in the midair and smashed, slammed right back down on the bar. And it was a glass ashtray but didn't break. The camera guy and the director both heard it. Everybody else saw it. That was a pretty impressive thing, and that hadn't even been the first thing that I'd seen happen. So that's a good example. At that place, we also had a chandelier just start swinging and then stop literally without momentum, just stop short when we had a medium with us who was talking to the ghost ostensibly, and he stopped it for her.
See, either one of those things would do it for me. Trust me, an ashtray rising into the air in front of my eyes, smashing back down, a chandelier swinging, and then stopping immediately. Either one of those things would so do it for me. I've done experiments. I really, during the years that I've been on the air, we talk about all this so much. I have taken pencils, and I have balanced them ever so delicately on the table. Got a pretty flat table. And then I have pushed on them. I have yanked on them. I have pushed my mind at them so hard that something ought to happen. It never has.
Well, you know, the one thing I've learned over the years, working with Martin Caden back in the 90s, he was able to turn small targets under glass, and actually he even did it standing outside a vacuum chamber, an atmosphere chamber, and had the targets inside the chamber with a fan that was not able to turn the targets. He was able to still move these things. And it turned out that what he learned, when he learned how to do it, it was not about concentration or pushing hard. It was about actually kind of seeing things happening and basically letting go of your emotion and kind of, if I have to be trite here, but trust the force. You have to kind of trust it to move.
Okay.
To see it actually moving at that point.
So in other words, visualize it occurring.
Right. But, you know, there's a problem here with psychokinesis or PK, and that is it's very much what happens in PK is very much related to performance psychology in general. And, you know, sports psychology has more to say about this area of parapsychology than I think any other area, because it really is about doubting that something is even possible. If you think it's impossible, nothing's going to happen. And your conscious mind gets in the way of moving things. And try as you might, there's still that belief that, you know, I've never done it before, I don't think I'm going to do it, but I'm going to try. And as Yoda said, there is no try, there is only do.
All right, I wanted to ask you, that brings to mind, you were on ESPN Sports Center, right?
Yeah.
Why? What did you do there?
25th anniversary edition of the Madden football game, NFL video game.
Yes.
They were doing a very big thing, and apparently there was a Madden curse. It was thought by many people that the player that was on the cover would get injured and would actually no longer be able to play, and that apparently happened. There were a couple of players, as it turned out, who were featured on previous editions of the Madden game, and something, you know, bad things happened to them. But there were a lot of other players where nothing happened to them, and they had me basically talking about the curse. And curses in general, and this actually kind of goes back, honestly, to the PK thing, because if you believe you are cursed, you are cursed, and it doesn't matter if anybody else said anything about it. It's kind of the reverse of the placebo effect.
Yeah. Well, what about Boston? I mean, what about that curse?
You mean the Red Sox?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, that lasted a long...
probably have more of a curse than anything else.
But that lasted a long, long time.
Yeah, I know.
That was a curse of the Bambino, I believe.
There may be belief. It could be the entire... the fan base may not be... maybe doing themselves a disservice by even considering that there's a curse.
You really think it could be a matter of intention? In other words, the people in Boston were so used to getting right up there and losing that they actually brought it on?
Well, either that or else the coaches and the owners just simply never put the right teams together until, you know, a certain point.
Well, that's being very practical of you.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it did go on for a long time. Chris Bambino, that was very well known, and it was general knowledge in Boston. So maybe they brought it on themselves. Could be.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, there is this thing called the placebo effect, which doctors, pharmaceutical companies measure their medicines against. And placebo is, whether it's a sugar pill or a saline solution,
mm-hmm.
It actually works on people. People actually do get better because they believe that what if they're being given, even if they're told it's a placebo, they can still actually have a positive effect on their own bodies. And it doesn't happen with everybody, but a lot of the medications that we're given or that are out on the market only have a very, very slight margin above placebo. And placebo doesn't have the side effects unless you tell people that the side effects are there.
That reminds me, Lloyd, I'm so sick of watching TV.
It is a
rule that drug companies must advertise every conceivable side effect known to mankind, up to and including death.
This is their legal disclaimer so they don't get sued.
Yeah. So I was going to make a fake advertisement for a pill. I mean, sick of your friends taking pills, not taking pills yourself. Here's a pill that does absolutely nothing. And then I was going to list every possible side effect up to and including death. But you'll never feel again like you're alone in not taking pills.
Right. But, you know, you might actually accidentally kill people with a little nocebo effect.
And get sued.
The reverse of the nocebo effect.
That's right. And get sued, no doubt. Certainly in modern America.
Yeah.
You have to wonder, you know, when they're sitting around in these advertising boardrooms, they must be thinking, do we really have to say all that?
Well, I'm sure that they are, and, you know, we now have to contend as investigators, we have to contend with many of the side effects, because some of what people report to us turn out to be side effects of sleep, you know, aids like Ambien, or they turn out to be some sort of interaction with various drugs. And it's one of the reasons why when we have cases, we really want cases where there's more than one witness, one person having the experience, because
mm-hmm.
The odds of a whole family being on the same medication are pretty slim. I mean, it's possible, but it's almost unheard of.
All right. So have you actually encountered, going back to psychokinetics,
yeah,
have you actually encountered anybody who on demand or very nearly on demand can demonstrate psychokinetic power?
Well, Martin Caden was one such person. He could do it, I'd say, probably about 80% of the time.
Really?
Although he did have kind of, if we set up more than a couple of targets, which we did in some circumstances in sealed rooms where he was outside the room.
Mm.
I think he had kind of a scattershot effect where he wasn't necessarily, we told him to focus on one target. It was usually the targets around it that moved, but that's still good enough as far as, this is one of those near miss is pretty good.
I don't know who Martin Caden is. Who is he?
So Martin Caden was a well-known science and science fiction writer. You would know his work. He's the creator of The $6 Million Man.
Hmm.
He wrote the book Cyborg, which became the first MOVE TV movie. He was the technical consultant on the show. He actually is credited with The Bionic Woman to some extent as well. And he also wrote the book Marooned, which was the actual impetus for the Apollo-Soyuz mission. The Russians, the cosmonauts, got to know his work, because Marty wrote a lot about space, both from a fiction and a science perspective, and he was an incredibly well-known pilot and aviator. So he actually was contacted and helped facilitate the Apollo-Soyuz mission to some extent. So he was a real straight shooter and kind of a larger-than-life character, a little bit of a blustery guy, but he could do psychokinesis, and he did it. He demonstrated it under extremely good conditions to me, and then I had affidavits from people at NASA because he still had connections to NASA, and people in the area in and around Cocoa Beach, other researchers who had worked with him under impeccable conditions.
Okay, if you don't mind, describe how impeccable it was and what he did.
All right, so the starting point is a paper pyramid. And anybody can do this. And actually, I've taught people to do this as well. So you can teach people to do this.
Okay.
It's a paper pyramid. It basically is balanced on a pin, and that's in a base. And, you know, if you let it settle, as long as you don't have a fan going, it's probably not going to do more than jiggle unless people are moving around the room or your air conditioning goes on.
Well, I'm not understanding. A paper pyramid settled on a pin?
It's balancing on a pin, on a point. So it's basically kind of like a little rotator. Think of it like a propeller, but
okay.
It's a pyramid.
All right.
All right. It's a paper hat, a pinwheel of sorts, if you want to call it that.
Okay.
And if you breathe on it or blow on it, it's going to spin.
All right.
In fact, if you breathe on it lightly, most of these are made out of light paper, so they're going to spin. So it's very important to either wear, what he did was wear a painter's mask to prevent that.
So you were actually watching Martin, so he wasn't going...
Well, actually, he demonstrated it for me with the targets under glass, in a sealed box.
Okay, now you're cooking.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that I will often work with people where they're not under glass just to get them going, and I think of it as a placebo, is they may be blowing on it, but it kind of gets them all jazzed up, and things then start happening, and then we put glass over it or a plastic dome or something, and the things will continue to turn. The key, you know, from a scientific perspective, you also have to make sure that there are no microcurrents in the air that are turning this thing. So an observational period, sitting there watching it, where nothing actually happens, and if it only turns when you intend it to turn, you have an incredibly interesting synchronicity with microcurrents, or you have psychokinesis happening.
And you saw this with your own eyes?
Yes, yes. And in fact, the first time I visited his home, he in Gainesville, he had a room upstairs where part of the room was cut off. He had built a wall with a big glass window. He had there was a door into that little room. He had a huge shelf with multiple targets set up of differing types,
okay.
Different materials, different sizes. He had a pinwheel sitting there. He had actually a pie tin that was balanced on a spindle with tinsel hanging down from the edges.
Got it.
And he had sealed the windows in the room with paint. He had actually covered all the outlets. There was actually no source of air, and even used weather stripping around the door. So after I set up all the targets, I went outside the room. We closed the room up. We left the room. We went downstairs for quite some time because I wanted to make sure that the targets settled down since they had been moving when I moved through the room. Got back upstairs. We waited about 15 minutes. At my urging, I told him to start, and within a minute, some of the targets started turning. And the most bizarre one that I saw, honestly, was the pie tin that was moving around. It wasn't spinning very fast, but it was spinning fast enough with the tinsel hanging straight down instead of trailing behind it, as it should with an air current.
All right. And when you inquired of Martin, and I'm sure you did, how he mentally was approaching this, he told you that it's a visualization process?
Yes. In fact, he kept a journal of how he learned to do it a few years before when he was challenged by another science fiction writer, Harry Stein, to do this. And he spent 3 weeks doing what we would normally think of doing, which is, you know, yelling at the thing, pushing with their minds, concentrating.
Oh,
probably
yeah. I've been going about it all the wrong way, sitting there going, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's exactly the opposite. It's think of it as a blank stare. You become a Vulcan. You become Mr. Spock, and it basically turns because of your intention, not because of any strong emotion you've got.
Wow.
Yeah, in fact, you know, it's kind of like what people did and I've done these myself more recently, the spoon-bending parties that Jack Houck did and other folks did back in the early 80s, where you'd actually get a bunch of people kind of... it's more chaotic, of course. You have them yelling at their spoons to bend, and you'd see people... after a little visualization induction that he did, and I do this now with groups, you'd see these people get blank stares. Their faces would go blank. They go into a light-altered state. And sometimes, you know, a lot of times they're using their strength to actually bend these things, kind of like a shock movement. But you end up with people twisting and tying very cheap spoons and other metal rods and other things into odd shapes that would normally snap. And I know this because we test those things first.
Sure.
But watching people do this, it's really interesting because their faces go blank. And it's almost as if they're watching their hands do things on their own. There's an altered state involved, and that light altered state, it's kind of like being in the zone, what athletes talk about as being in the zone.
Oh, I know all about being in the zone. It's not just athletes that get in a zone.
Right, that's correct.
Anybody, right. even people, the job I do here, I know, Lloyd, when I'm in the zone. It's a feeling that is hard to describe,
mm-hmm.
but it's like you can do no wrong.
Right.
And everything you do is going to go boom, 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 just exactly the way it's supposed to go. That's the zone, whether it's athletics or it's
artistic.
Yes, whatever it is, it's a definite place, this zone.
Yeah, and it's non-judgmental.
Right. It is. It's just.
It just is. That's correct.
It just is.
That's just the way PK seems to work.
I really have been going about it all the wrong way, and it's time for me to give it another shot. And that's probably what this program is going to get me to do. All these years and all that pushing for nothing. I understand the concept of the zone, and you're saying you've got to kind of get there in terms of the kind of visualization you're doing, but when you get that feeling, that zone feeling, then you're close to being able to do it.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So have you ever seen, I mean, those are all micro demonstrations in terms of the...
Well, they're not big things, that's correct.
They're not big things, although it doesn't matter. If it's real, it's real. Now, have there been demonstrations in the U.S. or Russia of things larger, heavier, bigger?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that we do set limits on what we even believe we can possibly witness. There was a researcher named Kenneth Batchelor who many, many decades back in the 60s, he came up with two things that really... prevent us from doing big things.
All right, hold that thought. We have a break. Okay, so I want to underscore that that lumen spot. I really do. I've had a whole bunch of people have emailed me. They all know how bad my back has been. And all I can tell you is it works. Honestly, for me, it worked. It's the only thing in all these years that has worked for my back. So, this LED therapy is amazing stuff. So... what I would suggest to you is look into it. I can't absolutely say it's going to work for everybody. I can only tell you that in a world of tried everything all my life, it's the only thing that actually ever worked. Lloyd, welcome back.
Thank you.
So all these things are very, very important to me because, again, they all go toward us being more than we are, one way or the other, up to the ultimate question of existence after death. And I would love to see a demonstration of psychokinetic ability. I would think that if you could do a little, then that's where we're kind of going. You could do, ultimately, if you kept at it, perhaps a lot.
Unless you had your own belief system that prevented you from thinking, it's kind of like, again, with The Empire Strikes Back, with Luke Skywalker not being able to raise the big object because he felt it was impossible to do that. And this is where the psychology of this performing PK or doing this stuff really gets in the way. Even Martin Kaden, because of his background in aviation, he felt that anything that had friction to it and drag, which you deal with when you're flying an airplane, would prevent you from easily moving the object. And I kept on telling him that wasn't the case, but that is something that we know from, again, the psychology of PK, which is why the big stuff happens with poltergeist cases, which are unconscious movements by PK of objects by living people.
And there are big things do move. Maybe you should have said, use the zone, Luke.
Right.
So with the poltergeist, funny, I just watched Poltergeist 2015, incidentally. I hear the groan and the hmm. So you watch these movies, right?
Some of them. Some of them are just, to me, almost going to be a waste of... I'm not a big horror fan, except for the old school stuff, and more horror comedy. So I don't always watch them, but I will probably watch Poltergeist, just because it is what it is.
Well, there's a great recommendation. I'll watch it because it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, I do try to keep up on pop culture, teaching a course on pop culture and psychic phenomena. So it's something I do keep up on. It's just if I can avoid some of the things that I see are just for shock value and really have no resemblance. Even from the trailers, it's easy to see they have no relationship.
Oh, I know. All right. But with a poltergeist, now you're talking about, is it fair to say an angry spirit?
No. The original use of the term poltergeist, which some of the historians in my field have tracked back at least as far as the 16th century in Germany, it was a term covering what they thought were ghosts. Now, remember, in the 16th century, people thought all sorts of things that were not true, as we have learned in science. And one of the things they thought is that there were spirits responsible for the movement of objects, which was very chaotic and physical. So unlike your typical ghost case where some people might see or experience things and not everybody does, in poltergeist cases, it's purely physical. There is almost never a sighting of a ghost or hearing.
How about a playful spirit?
Well, again, there's no indication that there's a spirit there at all. There is movement of objects, but what we have learned, and especially over the last 100 years, and especially in the last 75 years, thanks to the late Bill Roll, is that it's a living agent. It's a living person's unconscious that has caused these things.
Oh, they're unconscious.
It's their unconscious. It's not a conscious thing that's happening. And it can happen either because of stress-related things that are stressful in their life, kind of a telekinetic temper tantrum, that's kind of what it is. Or in a percentage of the cases, it seems to be related to a neurological state. And there has been a tie to some of the poltergeist agents having epilepsy or epileptiform activity. And that the poltergeist activity itself may, in fact, be the seizure.
So this is not a spirit at all.
The term poltergeist, the way we use it, it's not. It's not. It's pretty rare, actually, for ghosts to move things, and they certainly are not the chaotic stuff that we see in poltergeist cases. And again, with rarest of exceptions, ghosts are not seen in poltergeist cases. They're not experienced at all. And mediums don't pick anything up. Psychics don't pick anything up. It all seems to come from a living person.
Okay, so if there's something going on in your house, the first people you ought to look at are the ones around you, or in the mirror.
The way I can put it is, we have all, when we're under stress, had issues with our technology. Whether it's the printer not working, or especially, when I've talked to college students, they're always heads not. They're under stress, they're under deadline, they have to print out their paper to take right in because they're already late for class, and something screws up.
Okay, all right. Here's a key question for you, Lloyd. Have you ever shot a computer or a monitor or a keyboard? And when I say shot...
Are you being literal?
Yes, absolutely literal. Take it out, set it up, put a round in the chamber, and blow its little... You get the idea.
I have wanted to, but I have never done that.
I've done it once.
What I find is when I'm stressed out, my things just don't work right, and it's my little poltergeist thing that's happening at that moment.
I'm probably fully capable of a telekinetic temper tantrum. If I could do
Pretty much everybody is in our society today.
Now that you've taught me how to do it, look out. I'm kidding, kind of. I I think it's very interesting. I think the whole thing is interesting. I always thought that there really were poltergeists in the way I thought of them, and you've completely turned me around on that. So it's generally somebody in the family, somebody around you, or yourself. And and it's not conscious thought doing it.
No, but we've had in our relatively recent history over the last 40 years, we've had a very few poltergeist agents who, when they were identified and worked with by the researcher, they were able to shift the activity over to a more conscious activity for a time. It kind of burned itself out, usually, but it was still possible to get, if they gained acceptance and took responsibility for it and kind of played with it, they could do it consciously, and the unconscious stuff stopped.
All right. It is generally thought, Lloyd, that young teenage girls just coming into it have more capabilities in these areas, conscious or unconscious. Generally, more of this stuff happens around them. True or false?
Well, I think we can thank Stephen King for creating that stereotype, if that answers your question. The answer.
Thank you, Stephen.
False. Yeah. It is true that the majority of poltergeist agents are between the ages of probably 11 or 12 and early 20s. So it is in adolescence, and puberty is right in the center of that. It is not true that it's predominantly females. It really follows the population statistics, actually. And it really is, part of this has to do with whether individuals, or, you know, if you look at boys and girls and who has the physical outlet, today we're having certainly less female poltergeist activity than even before, because girls are actually out there playing soccer and field hockey and all sorts of stuff. And without, it's always been that the poltergeist agents have not been physically active people. They've been kind of, they have no other outlet for their stress, typically. And that's the same thing goes for adults. I mean, it's 60% in the adolescent range, but we have 40% that go beyond that. And I actually had a poltergeist agent who was 80 years old years ago.
So there's hope for me.
Yeah.
Not that I really want to be a poltergeist.
I'll get something to you, Art, the kind of Martin Caden's method. I'll get something to you on that.
I am very interested. And I particularly like the visualization part. For a generally lazy person, the visualization part seems so much easier than all that grunting and pushing and trying to tip. And I really work at it.
So much of that is Hollywood, unfortunately. You know, it's that throbbing vein in the head, which makes it look like your head's about to explode, like in the movie Scanners or something.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, it's not the way. When people really do PK, you see the same. When you see psychic healers, and healing is, energy healing is a form of PK, there's a more serene, less concentrated look on their faces. Meditators, it's the same thing. So it's not about that, you know, in the head. It's more about a calm and seeing what needs to happen at that point.
Well, I have to start from the beginning. All right. So the Russians, and I presume we, the U.S., certainly looked into the existence of ESP. We did so officially. We did it with government programs.
Right.
How much do you know about how much they know?
Well,
what a way.
Our government programs, you know, we had different programs in the 50s, the 40s, the 50s. We had the MK Ultra programs, which were more directed at mind control, although they had an interest in somehow doing telepathy, and that was akin to what the Russians were interested in, which was telepathic mind control, which never really worked on either side, as it happens. And the Russians got, you know, really concerned about what we were doing because of an experiment in apparent telepathic communication with a U.S. submarine when that was leaked, and probably purposefully leaked to the
Russians. Really?
Yeah. Back in the late 50s. You know, it's hard to communicate with deep submarines because...
Oh, yes.
You know, if you got all that water in the way, so if you could telepathically communicate, that'd be a major advantage. And the Russians felt that we must be spending lots of money on it, so they decided to really start spending on this. And they were encouraged, the scientists were encouraged in many different directions to create some sort of mind control. A man named L.L. Vasiliev did quite a bit of work in writing, which we have access to here in the States, and his books are still in print, of telepathic hypnosis, which did require the person being hypnotized first, given a post-hypnotic suggestion, and you could trigger it telepathically, apparently, but you couldn't do mind control without first hypnotizing them. So that kind of...
Well, why would that matter to our government, who has experimented on people with LSD and,
they've done
all kinds of things. So hypnotizing somebody, no problem.
Yeah, the Russians were, if you remember seeing, and you can still see footage of a very famous Russian psychic, Nina Kulagina, moving objects, doing PK.
Uh-huh.
It's if you do Russian telekinesis, you'll typically see on YouTube, you'll typically see Nina Kulagina moving objects. And the Russians actually figured out how she was doing it, which was really interesting. Oh. That was one of the things that when I was going through the material that we had gotten from our Russian sources, that really just jumped out. It was almost a minor piece in the books, in the material we got from them. And it was very interesting because Kulagina was doing something. This is back to what you said about us being more than we think we are.
Yes.
And that's what keeps me in the field, honestly. It's that idea that we are more, we set limits on ourselves, and we are more than we think we are. So here's Nina Kulagina moving objects, including non-metallic objects. And what they find out is that she was kind of stressing so much that she sweat a lot. And in her sweat, when they analyzed her sweat, was contained histamines, as in the stuff that we take antihistamines for.
I know what those are.
And histamines do react to electrostatic fields. So she's picking up an object, putting it back down, her sweat's getting on them. She's then generating an electrostatic field of enough magnitude, which our bodies can generate biologically, to actually move the objects. So,
well, even that's impressive.
Now, here's the thing. You know, I had my co-author, Ed May, does not really believe in psychokinesis. He fully believes in precognition and remote viewing because that's what he did and continues to do. But he said, well, there you go. There's an explanation. That's not psychokinesis. But if we define psychokinesis as mind over matter, she certainly didn't know how her body could generate histamines or an electrostatic field. She just knew she wanted to move the objects.
Did they actually measure the electrostatic field? Because
yes, apparently they did. At least that's the information we got from General Savin and General Ratnikov.
All right. That's really something. Electrostatic field. I've got to think about that. That'd be quite a bit of voltage from the body. Right? Lloyd Auerbach is here, and he's a really, really interesting guy. Anything at all in, you know, the genre, he apparently is prepared to talk about. And I've got somebody, you know, I get messages as I do the show. And Monrovia sends me I have to be so careful how I say this, sends me a wormhole message about shadow people. And what does Lloyd believe about shadow people? What is the nature of this phenomenon? Do you know anything about shadow people at all?
Well, you know, we have cases which may not fit into this. Certain authors have kind of defined that there are multiple types of shadow people. The ones that we deal with, the shadows that we deal with in parapsychology, tend to be, you might say, not well-received signals from a ghost, or from the background residual memory that's in the place. Sometimes people pick up kind of a fuzzy image and it gets seen as a shadow. The cases we have where people see dark shadows, they tend to eventually resolve themselves into looking more human, or can be identified by other people. One person may see a shadow, the other person may see an actual fully formed apparition, another person may just hear something. So it seems to be about... We're the receivers. We're the TV sets, and the signal is there, and it's right. It's just there's something wrong with how we receive or process the image.
Okay. All right, Lloyd, I haven't listened every night, you can't know this. Several years ago, many years ago, on the other show, I talked about this because people called in about it, and I found it interesting, and then I suddenly found it fascinating because people were sending me photographs and talking all about it, and I had never heard of shadow people. Mm-hmm. And so many years went by, and before I started doing this program, I don't know, weeks before, a couple weeks before at least, maybe 3 weeks before, I was sitting at my computer. I was starting to do prep and reading for the show and spending a lot of time on the computer very late at night. And I saw one, Lloyd. Here's what happened. I had been hours and hours on the computer, and I saw something to my right. And I looked over, and there was like a human form there.
Mm-hmm.
Not arms outstretched or anything, arms down, I guess, but a human form of some kind. And then I sort of went into shock for a second. I turned around, it was gone. I looked back behind me, it was there. And at this point, I'm really, really freaking out. And I swung back toward the computer, and then it was on my left. And, oh, my God, I told the audience about this. I went around the house, checking windows, doors. I actually got a gun. It really scared me, Lloyd. Whatever it was, it scared me. And here's my theory, for what it's worth, which ain't much. And that is that staring at a computer for hours and hours and hours begins to adjust your brain to the refresh rate of the computer, whatever, you know, that mm-hmm. happens to be. And then you might start to see things that you don't normally see. And that's an out-the-window theory. But I had talked to other people who had seen things after staring at a computer screen monitor for a long time. And that's the only thing I can come up with. But it sure scared me.
And it scared you because it was an intruder, or it scared you because it was a dark shadow?
Yes, to both.
To both, okay.
I mean, I don't know what it was. It scared me because I didn't know what it was.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, what gets reported to us normally, which we look into when we can look into it, in a situation like your case, there's not much we can do.
No, of course not.
Other than take that, right?
It's like a UFO sighting, you know?
Right, yeah, with repeated sightings of things, we can actually kind of go in and see if there's any, even with psychics or with sensitive, and see whether or not there's anything that they're picking up. And what we tend to find in these cases with shadows is that, like I said before, they tend to resolve themselves into either what we would call a ghost, or sometimes into a person picking up imprints or you might say images of the past, which seem to be in the location.
Images of the past. That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the whole idea, we make a difference between hauntings and ghosts, or apparitions and hauntings. And a haunting is related to a place, sometimes to an object, and it has to do with a replay. People experience a replay of, think of it as a tape loop, of a video loop, of an event that happened in the past, which is not necessarily of dead people. It can be of living people as well. And it can be also very historical, like the battlefield at Gettysburg, where you have a running loop many people pick up the battle itself. But it's not about ghosts. There aren't actual conscious beings there. It is a recording that people are tapping into. And people can get a feeling. In fact, probably the most common type of haunting or this type of experience that people have, you walk into a house,
okay, and
especially your house hunting, and you feel weird vibes,
bad
vibes.
In what medium is this recording or whatever it is maintained? In other words, where does it...
Well, we're trying to figure that out. This is something that it would be great to have some funding in parapsychology to be able to look more further into this from a physics perspective. It seems to be partly geophysical. We do find a connection to the local geomagnetic field of the Earth, which may or may not be holding the information, or may just be triggering us being psychic and picking that information up. This is why when you see ghost hunters running around on TV using electromagnetic field detectors,
yes,
the reason they started doing that is because we were doing that in the early 80s and even before that, and finding a correlation between the residual or imprint hauntings, the spots that people said, that's where I see the thing happening, and higher than background magnetic fields that didn't seem to have any...
Using what, magnetometers?
Yeah, we use various types of magnetometers, yeah.
And you're looking for very, very small variations, I would assume.
Sometimes. sometimes, you know, that's the thing. We hope that there's more than just a small variation. But even finding any variation in a consistent manner, if the corner of one room in a house is where people are feeling a bad, they have a bad feeling there, or
right.
they
right.
are seeing visually in their minds,
right.
or even what they think is their eyes, they're visually seeing something, somebody killing someone, which has happened in a few cases.
Mm.
You know, that kind of thing, which is historically accurate, by the way, is recorded into the environment somehow, and we have a couple of possible ideas about how this may be happening, and even a couple potential experiments, which we're trying to get some funding for. But
really,
it's you know, there's some ideas that are floating around right now. But the reason we're using magnetometers is was to originally see if this correlation held up, and whether or not there's anything in the environment that may actually connect to the psychic experience.
People have suggested that windows or glass could well have memory of a sort.
Yeah. Well, liquid is often thought of having memory. We store information in an electromagnetic field. Magnetic memory is what videotape is, what audio tape is. It's kind of what flash drives are.
And thank God that beds don't remember. All right.
Dark Matter News. I'm Leo Ashcraft. A devastating storm ripped through the Southwest, causing flash floods from Los Angeles to Utah. Particularly hard hit was Utah-Arizona border town of Hilldale, the home base of Warren Jeffs' polygamous sect, the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the FLDS. Reports confirm that 13 were killed in the flash flood that, according to eyewitness Chris Weiler, only seemed to last about a half an hour or 45 minutes. According to Utah officials in the city of Hilldale and the Washington County Emergency Services, among the dead are at least 3 women and 6 children, ranging in age from 4 years old to teenagers. Hilldale Assistant Fire Chief Kevin Barlow said water rises 1 to 1.5 feet at normal flood stage. A river gauge on Short Creek at Colorado City measured a nearly 3.5-foot rise in just 19 minutes due to the first wave of flooding around 3:18 that afternoon, and then a second wave about 90 minutes later produced a rise of nearly 5.5 feet in 17 minutes. By late Monday, the water had mostly receded, but as of Tuesday evening, storms threatened yet another round of flooding. Authorities say that around 150 people from county, state, and federal agencies, 500 community volunteers, and 6 or 7 search dogs are working at search and rescue efforts in Hilldale and its sister town across the Arizona border, Colorado City. Wild weather patterns aside, the Southwest is very familiar with flash flooding, even if some of its inhabitants have forgotten, and remembering to give rising water levels of wide girth is rule number one. A flash flood can happen in a matter of minutes, sweeping away cars and, in some extreme cases, entire houses. Do you think these are the same weather systems that wreaked havoc across Europe earlier this month? Check out the full article from Kingslayer and let us know your thoughts at darkmatternews.com. A new NASA-sponsored competition hopes to unlock the secrets of space colonization through user-submitted design proposals. Called the 3D Printed Habitat Challenge, NASA hopes that the competition will help to develop the fundamental technologies necessary to manufacture an off-world habitat using mission-recycled materials and/or local indigenous materials. They say the vision is that autonomous habitat manufacturing machines will someday be deployed to the moon or Mars to construct shelters for human habitation. A lot of fancy speech for a simple idea. Using 3D printers to build structures using materials which already exist on the planet. NASA goes so far as to speculate that the same concept, if such an idea is feasible enough, could be applied to life here on planet Earth. There are several designs that have so far made it to the finalist round. You can check out many of them in an extensive article from Kingslayer on darkmatternews.com. The world of the paranormal has experienced a great loss in the passing of Jim O'Connell. He was the founder of Experiencers.com, a group whose purpose was to lend support to anyone who had experienced alleged contact with extraterrestrials. Jim O'Connell was a UFO and alien researcher for over 20 years. He mysteriously passed away in his sleep in his Connecticut home on September 9th. He was the founder and lead investigator of the new television show Experiencers. In his show, a team of investigative researchers travel around the United States to personally interview people who had alleged direct contact with extraterrestrial beings. This year, they were focusing on the American Southwest. They plan to include other regions as the seasons of the show progressed. Dark Matter News staff writer Alana Fox Stark has prepared an extensive biography and article highlighting the life of Jim O'Connell and his work at darkmatternews.com. I'm Leo Ashcraft, Dark Matter News.
Kind of what we're talking about, right? Time after time after time. Some sort of tape loop going in the universe that occasionally gets seen again and again and again. Maybe it goes on forever. Who knows? Lloyd Auerbach is my guest. Welcome back, Lloyd.
Thank you, Art.
Okay. So kind of like that, huh? Kind of like a tape loop, something that imprinted somehow on something, and it just keeps repeating.
It keeps repeating, or, that's kind of how we know it's not evidence for survival, that it's not a conscious entity. There's no reaction. You know, when you talk about ghosts, one of the more important things for us when we're trying to classify a case or even deal with the situation is interaction, or at least an awareness by, that being that we're here and that there's some consciousness behind them, as opposed to a hologram that just doesn't react.
So then you've got to wonder sometimes when you're in contact with something that you think might be on the other side, whether you're really in contact with something on the other side in contemporary time, or you're in contact with what was and still is if you seek it. Does that make sense? Put it that way?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. You know, we do wonder with any of the cases whether or not it's our own ESP picking up on something through time. And, you know, are we picking up on something that happened here? Is it really, in reality, we don't know if it's an imprint or that spot, for whatever reason, allows us to peer into the past. I mean, that's another way of looking at it. And, we can certainly tell the future. We might be able to certainly can look into the past.
Okay. Listen, a lot of people want to talk to you, and okay. I've hogged you far too long. So with this many lines ringing, I better do something. Trish Ray, hello? Hello, Trish? All that time, and she's not there. All that waiting, that's crazy. Okay, let's go to the phones. Portland, Oregon, I believe. You're on the air with Lloyd.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Josh from Moala, Oregon.
Okay.
And fun thing is, I was listening to your radio shows on, and I was also you said something about the end of the world, how people have been raving about that.
Well, I read an
September thing, like that's the September, like what's going to happen in September.
Yeah.
And I ended up having a dream this morning was about like an apocalyptic, like storm, like tornado. Like I don't dream that often.
Right.
And I want to know also, I mean, because I've personally had dreams that actually happen later in the future, but I mean, apocalyptic, that's kind of got my attention, kind of thing.
Well, you may be a victim.
I mean, what's your outlook on that September, like people raving about that, like Planet X thing?
Lloyd, you know what? I'll let you handle that one.
Okay. Well, we do associate, and there was last week some concern about some terrorist attacks on the anniversary of September 11th. So September does have an association with certainly the end of the world, and our world changed on September 11, 2001. We did have an end of the world. We had an ending to kind of the way that we viewed the world.
Well, it ended for some people, and our model of the world certainly changed, but not really the
end. It wasn't an apocalyptic thing, and I don't subscribe to the apocalyptic ending idea. And even when you're talking about dreams, the caller said that he doesn't dream. That he remembered this dream is important, certainly to him, and there's something perhaps in that. but he does dream. We all dream, unless you have a really bizarre sleep pattern. We may not remember our dreams, but we all dream. And there may have been something very negative in that, and maybe because it was spurred on by all this talk of something bad happening could have created that dream, or he may actually have had a dream of something negative about to happen in his world, not necessarily to the whole world.
Well, you know, there's a little bit of me that does worry when people are having these mass thoughts that the end is coming. And I know it happens, you know, every few years it comes along again and again and again, and the world never ends. However, one of these days, they could be right.
Someone could push the button.
Push the button. There's a million ways we could go. Things, biological warfares, that sort of thing that could take us all out. There's just lots of ways, you know, an asteroid could come.
Right. I personally choose to live and, you know, to not live in the idea that there is the sword of Damocles is floating over our heads. So
I think it's overexposure to the internet.
Yeah.
Personally. That's just me.
And just, you know, just news media in general has been this way. You know, people don't care for good news. It doesn't get good ratings. People get, you know, disasters make good ratings, and can even preparing for disasters like the Y2K issue.
Oh, yes.
Can really generate a lot of income for people, too.
Well, actually, the Y2K thing was real. I mean, there were a lot of computers that would have been in trouble if we hadn't warned. Anyway,
we did a lot of stuff there that was potentially real. It may or may not. We don't even actually know what would have happened if we hadn't done anything, except that stuff would have happened. We just don't know what
would have happened. That's right. I hear something in the background. Is that a kitty cat or is that a child?
Yeah, you did hear a cat in the background, yeah.
I thought it might have been a cat. All right, Scott on Skype, you're on the air with Lloyd. Hi.
Hi, Art. Hi, Lloyd.
Hi.
I've wondered about this for decades, 30 years at least. I am pretty good at psychometry, holding something, an object, and getting impressions from it about the person or the object or the history.
Yeah.
Am I getting the information from the person or from the object, or is it both? Because the first few times it freaked me out, but like you were talking earlier, there's no strain or grunting or anything with it. It's just a matter of holding it, relaxing it, and going with whatever impressions I pick up.
Well, you know, psychometry is actually fairly easy. It's of all the psychic abilities, it's one of the easier ones, I should say, for people to at least tap into a little bit. And when I was talking about hauntings a few minutes ago, if you think about a house is just a big object. So when people are having these experiences, they're kind of doing psychometry on the house or parts of the house. What you're picking up on, we're not sure, and this is where we get back to these models of what's going on with hauntings, too. We're not sure if the information is imprinted in the object that you're holding or if the object is some kind of focal point. It's a focus. It's kind of like the coordinates in a remote viewing experiment that lets you zero in on the target, which is the person or the history of that object. So it's still kind of up in the air for either one of those things, but people do amazing things with psychometry. That's how some police psychics actually work, too. And archaeological psychics have worked with psychometry quite a bit.
Well, a jet is flying over, sorry. I found it to be very impressive and very detailed. I mean, I did a reading once for someone who said the hair on the back of her neck stood up because I was describing events about places and people I'd never met or never been to.
Sir, next time you call, make sure you turn down your jet.
Okay, I promise. Well, they're flying a different pattern because of the rain tonight in San Diego.
Okay. Anyway, it's very interesting. He's right. If you hold an object, you can get a kind of I don't know what the right word is, a story, a sense, a feeling. What is it, Lloyd? What do you call it?
Yeah, it's, you know, your free associate. You open your mind. You just start talking about what this is. Literally what remote viewing is also. You're kind of using a focus. In this case, it could be the information that's imprinted. You know, when you're telling stories, doing psychometric reading, you're telling stories about the person's past. The question would then be, was this object actually in the location for the at the time of those stories, mm-hmm. which would indicate that possibly the object did absorb the information, or if the object just simply belonged to the person, but that person didn't have it at that those locations, then you really are using it as a focal point.
Well, this one particular one that was really impressive, the item my wife had at the time had belonged to her mother, mm-hmm. and it was about events happening to her mother's siblings when they were children. And it just blew us both away. It was really incredible. But thanks for the information. I'm going to do more research.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. Fascinating stuff, no question. Let's go outside the country to Charles, who is calling, I think, from Bangkok, Thailand.
Yes, exactly. How copy?
5x5.
Excellent. I'm so excited about today's guest and today's topics because I've personally experienced witnessed a remote viewing episode and several others that no one was around to watch. But it's very difficult to live in America and pursue paranormal experiences and research and so on because of the massive rejection. So I've, among many reasons, moved to Thailand. Mm-hmm. And here, of course, spirits are everywhere. And
right.
Nobody is going to put you down for any of these, mm-hmm. what Americans would call stupid stuff. And I have one suggestion that could explain how a person could read something about the past or even something about the future, which Tibetan Buddhism answers. It's remarkable how close Tibetan Buddhism for centuries has been to answering many of these questions and many of these experiences because Tibetan Buddhism also anticipates quantum mechanics. It's really something to read. So I suggest that time is continuous. Mm-hmm. It always has been. It always will be. And the present, the past, and the future are always right there. If we can overcome our fear or in some ways be triggered to cross the disbelief barrier and reach those moments in especially the past, but they're always there. That's the thing. They're not being recalled. They're just being tapped.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, guest?
Well, you know, that is one model of time, is that time is simultaneous, that all moments in time exist at the same moment. It's really our consciousness that shapes the direction of what we're doing. And, you know, that's one concept. There are those people who subscribe to the idea that there is actually no time at all, that it's really all consciousness. And then there are those that say the past has happened and the moments are gone, but the future is something that is about to happen, so we can kind of pick up a probable future. It's hard to say. I mean, there's even the idea that every moment in the past is actually becomes a parallel universe or a different way, a different access point in the multiverse that's there. And I'm not actually sure myself which is which. I do see what happens with these hauntings where people seem to pick up on what looks to be a very programmed recording. And yet there are also stories of what are called time slips.
Oh, you know what? We just lost him. We just lost him. There's a, just as he was mentioning time slips, boom, he was gone, just like that. You know, one thing, this phone that I have literally has everything that a person could want. I mean, there is a button on here for everything. And there are buttons on here for things that I don't even know, frankly, what they are. We lost them, so we'll just pick up a couple lines till the break. We'll get them back at the break. Weird stuff. Hello there. You're on the air.
Hello, Art. This is Plasma on Polariton in Richmond, Virginia, listening on WTWW shortwave.
Yes, sir.
85 kilohertz. Getting a good signal tonight. Sorry we lost him right then because I had a really good question for him.
Really good? Okay, I will. I will write it down.
Well, it's a little complicated, but basically, I called you before one time when you were talking about these dark shadows. We built a box that would allow 3D visualizations, which would interact with your brainwaves. And I took this to the Richmond, Virginia Department of Ophthalmology at the Medical College.
I'm already confused. Hold on a moment, please. You built a box which would allow visualization of 3D brainwaves?
It would interact with your brainwaves and make you see a whole other visual field, okay? And it used something called pattern light. And I took it to the experts at the Medical College of Virginia and showed all the neuro-ophthalmologists one night, and they couldn't explain it either. But they
was it, well, I know the brain, of course, responds to electrical stimuli. Is that what you were doing?
It's essentially patterned light stimuli with certain, you know, pulse width modulated patterns impressed on light. Then later, after the neuro-ophthalmology, I had sessions with people where I had six visual field helmets that you could wear that would, you know, everybody would have the same visions at the same time. And at a certain point in the frequency tuning, everybody would suddenly see the inside their own eye, there's a retina vein that pops into place. You can see your own veins in your eye at that point, at that frequency range. And it would happen to everybody all at once. And it struck me as odd that we're so wired the same way, that everybody sees their own veins in their eye at the same frequency point. And so later I took this and added the ability to put musical inputs into it to vary the images you'd see. And we held a concert in Northern California. I only had six headset units, and the band was playing, and everybody was grooving to the 3D visuals they were seeing in their mind's eye. But what would happen when you hit that trip point where you see the veins in your eyes, other people in the room in the concert, about 200 people, only six were wearing the units, and they would see the images too at that point. Which made me think, okay, there's some kind of transmission going on between people's brains where they're synchronizing and seeing this vein pattern of each individual vein in each eye.
Again, I want to understand how you are transmitting this information to these people. Through what process?
That's what I was going to ask Lloyd.
Well, you mean you don't know?
I've never been able to figure it out why people who weren't wearing the visual helmets were able to somehow transmit to the others in the audience, you know, from the people that were, and they see the image too, especially when you hit that certain frequency where you see the veins in your eyes. After that, they synchronize, and they start to see the visions that the six people in the room wearing the helmets were getting off the band's music.
Who built these, and when they built them, they must have had a goal in mind electronically of what they were going to do, right?
Well, I built it. I'm kind of an electrical engineer. I was contracted for the Science Museum of Virginia to do a project where we were building a rocket launching system. I got these huge LED displays, and I was pulsing them just to make them look brighter than mine. You know, and it turns out the pulse would hit on a certain frequency. And I was standing back looking at my work, watching the countdown timer for this rocket launcher, and suddenly I realized I'm seeing speckles in the image on these big readouts as if it was a laser source. But where was the coherence coming from? As I investigated it...
Okay, listen. All right. Listen to me, sir.
Yeah.
Stop.
Yeah, I'm listening.
You win. I'm going to hold you over. I'm going to try and get my guest back. I could never possibly describe all of this to him, so I'm going to let you do it, okay?
Yeah, it's hard to write that down.
All right, that's all right. Hold on, please. Thank you.
Want to take a ride from the high desert and the great American Southwest? This is Midnight in the Desert, exclusively on the Dark Matter Digital Network. To call the show, dial 1-952-CALL-ART. That's 1-952-225-5278.
All right. I think we've straightened it all out. Lloyd, are you there?
I am.
Okay. So I had a caller on. I don't know if you continued to listen to the show. I'm going to have to find the caller among all these calls because I had to put everybody on hold to try and get you back.
Right.
So hello there. Were you the caller
you
that was...
the caller back.
Yeah,
yes.
Good. Good shot. First time.
Sure,
all right.
First time, sure.
So Lloyd is here. Try and describe, if you will, what you did to me in a short time and see if we can make sense of it.
All right. Well, Lloyd, did you hear any of the what was on the air that I said earlier?
I did not.
Okay. Well, try to make it really succinct here. I have developed this pattern light thing that it's like a 3D visor that you can wear. And it's sort of accidentally, while I was working on another project, I found out the light that was being emitted from some LEDs was actually because I was pulsing them, was interacting somehow to make it look like speckles like you'd see from a laser. And I determined that, in fact, there was no speckles in the light I was looking at. What was happening is the coherence that you'd normally expect to come from a laser beam was occurring in the neural network in my own brain, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's where the coherence was coming from. I tried magnifying it, didn't obey the laws of optics, and finally I said, this has got to be in my brain. So I further researched, and I found out that I could make a dream machine where I could basically dial up 3D images in my mind's eye, separate from my regular visual field. And that was pretty cool. I showed it to the neuro-ophthalmology department at a local medical school, and they thought it was fascinating and couldn't explain it either. And then I added an audio input and went out and did a concert in Northern California where there were a band, and there were 6 people wearing these visor helmet kind of things that were grooving to the musical patterns in their mind's eye. And the rest of the people in the audience, there was about 200, at some point when a certain frequency hit and it clicked on so that everybody with the visor saw the vein in their own retina at that point, which is normally blanked out in your regular vision. Your brain is blocking that out so that it doesn't interfere with your visual field. Well, everybody else, when you hit that frequency where you see your retina vein, started picking up on the images too, even though they weren't wearing the visor.
So a transference of a generated vision or whatever it was you saw. Okay, I get it.
It was a group of 6 who were actively seeing the vision, and the other ones started picking up on it, the other 100 and some people.
Right, okay. I think we've got it. Lloyd?
I don't know what to make of it. I mean, that's something that really should be taken a look at a little bit further because my colleague Ed May, who, again, the main author on ESP Wars, if you approach psychic ability from the perspective he is, which is that it's really an issue for physics and neuroscience, that technically we might be able to develop a psychic chip for artificial intelligence. We might be able to duplicate it. And that's kind of the way he's approaching it because he's coming from a very materialist perspective. And, you know, I'm sure if what you're describing could be replicated and studied further, there might be something really interesting here, certainly.
So, all right. Let's say he wants to contact you and have you look into this. How do we contact you?
Well, my website is mindreader.com. That's easy to remember.
Ooh, good one.
Yep, and my email is profparanormal, that's as in Professor Paranormal, @gmail.com.
Mindreader.com. I really like that one.
Yeah, a buddy of mine snagged that back in the mid-90s.
Way to go. Okay, Jonathan, welcome to the show. You're on the air on Skype.
Hi, Art.
Hi.
It's great to meet you.
Thank you.
Hi, Lloyd. Great to meet you as well. I got several of your books. I read several of them.
Great.
I just had a question regarding an experience I had several years ago. I'm not sure if you encountered it in your research or not. If you can roll out the normal, any normal circumstances, I was wondering, let me get to it. So I was sitting watching TV with my family, and I got up, and on my way out from the room, I noticed that there was this, it looked like a wavery effect in the environment, and around it was like this white mist, but it was very thin, and it started to move towards the center of the room. So at first I thought it was my eyes, but I noticed at the same time my mom, she screamed like, "Oh my god!" And I said like, "Oh my gosh!" Like, what was this? And I was wondering if, like in your book, if it was related to like recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis or if it was some type of apparition materializing. But like in the house, we don't have any paranormal, any paranormal activity.
Well, what you described sounded like an apparition to me.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it very well could have been. People tend to think that the houses, that they're stuck in houses, and they're not. We have kind of stories and cases even of apparitions kind of like wandering throughout a neighborhood until somebody could see them. And it may just be that this person, whoever was walking around or moving around through your house at that moment, did not have a good signal. Was not putting out a good enough signal for you to see who they were. The kind of effect in the air, almost like a heat effect off the road, is that kind of what you're talking about?
Right.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, he's not here, but yes.
He's not here, but yeah, I'm assuming that's what he's talking about. That's something that people have reported with apparitions, and sometimes if they do stick around, then people do eventually learn to see them and actually can see them kind of fully.
I don't know if that's a talent I want to acquire at all.
Well, you know, I think the worst thing about ghosts that could be in your house is that it's the invasion of privacy and you never know if somebody's watching you or not.
Well, there is that. But
yeah, I've never been worried about being injured, hurt, or otherwise affected by any of the cases or ghosts that I've dealt with. But there's always that wondering, you know, who's watching me now?
That's right. All right, let's go to the next call. Hi.
Hi, Art. Thank you for taking my call. This is the person who was calling about simulation yesterday. I just have a couple of quick questions and one quick comment. My quick comment, first of all, is for the people speculating about the end of the world. I think it's just sufficient to say that we're probably living through it right now with global warming. And I appreciate what you talk about with what we do to the planet.
Yeah, I'm going to have a serious guest on that subject, by the way.
I appreciate it. It's a topic that I'm very interested in.
I'm really, really, really tired of the oil company followers who are putting out this tripe when real science will tell you what's going on, and that's where we're going, real science.
Me too. I think it's disgusting what they suppress. They suppress, you know, electric vehicles. They prevent research and development in other areas. And
well, it's worse than that. They lie. They say that global warming is all a lie, that the climate change is all a lie, and that oil renews itself. And, oh, I could go on and on and on, and I won't right now, but it's coming. Anyway.
Well, thank you. And my quick questions to the guest, I'm sure you remember a couple of weeks ago you had on a guest that spoke about people disappearing in the woods. And my question deals with what Lloyd was talking about with, I guess, shadow people.
Mm-hmm.
And if he thinks there might be any correlation or whether there's any like similarities between either, you know, these people that talk, like children who talk about seeing fuzzy men in the woods with their eyes, or whether they talk about Slender Man or some voodoo type stuff. And then my final question deals, because I am interested in simulation, whether the people in the woods, like the different ghosts who are repeating and repeating, whether this might be an instance of not quite frame drag, but sort of a glitch in the system where there's this sort of remembrance in the, I guess you could say, like the DNA of the area. And a quick shout out to the Facebook group Midnight in the Desert, and thank you very much, Art. I appreciate it.
Sure. That's a lot to cover. So the shadow people thing, sir, tomorrow night we're going to have a guest specifically on shadow people. I shouldn't be giving that away, but I don't care. If you want to expand on that, Lloyd, you're welcome to. Or you can move on to, you know, like Bigfoot and that kind of thing that are seen. He asked about that.
Yeah.
Slenderman and voodoo, yes.
Yeah.
Well, what about voodoo? I mean, voodoo is a religion. It's that does use magic, or at least, you know, there's variations of it. And it's based in West African beliefs. And there's nothing inherent in voodoo that's any different than any other religion, really, other than they do use psychic ability from time to time, and that's certainly nothing inherently bad about voodoo that's there.
Okay. What about these creatures that are seen, the Bigfoot, the you name it. There's all kinds of monsters, but Bigfoot is one of the very common ones seen in the woods again and again and again.
I don't really get into cryptids too much, although I do have a background in anthropology from undergrad and was always interested in Bigfoot and some of the other things. And I mean, my professors, the physical anthropology professors that I was talked to at Northwestern about it, because back in my college days, I was into a lot of different things, seem to have no problem with there being a giant ape running around.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a paranormal aspect to it, or there could be.
Yeah. There could very, very well be, and It's like, you know, I went to school at Northwestern when Jalen Hynek was there, and he was the chairman of our astronomy department, and I interacted with Hynek quite a bit.
Yeah.
And he had always told me, because he was very knowledgeable about parapsychology, and I actually know Jacques Vallée, and there's this issue of whether some of these things, whether they're, you know, some UFOs certainly seem to be nuts and bolts hardware, but then there's some stuff that may be, as Hynek put it, psychic projections, kind of what even Jung talked about.
There you go.
And it may be that we may have real giant apes running around, but then we also may have psychic projections because we believe in giant apes running around, and there may be something else going on, too. It's kind of a, it is a mystery, and mysteries are always good. It's just unfortunate that mainstream science doesn't want to look at these mysteries.
All right, I am going to answer this call, even though the person calling himself Quick Guy is sitting in a chair with a weird expression on his face and a glass of booze in his hand. It doesn't encourage me to answer the call, but I'm going to. Quick Guy, hello.
You got me down to a T, buddy. How am I sounding?
So far, okay.
All right. Much obliged. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I got a question for your guest, Lloyd. Lloyd, hello.
Yeah, hi.
My question relates to sort of when that segment of the show when we were talking about the zone and how to use psychokinesis. I'm a bit of a history student myself, specifically in Asian history, and a previous caller had mentioned Buddhism. Mm-hmm. I wanted to touch on Shaolin and the amazing physical abilities that the Shaolin Buddhist monks have been able to achieve in their temples and the like in terms of being able to change their body temperatures, meditate for days on end without food and such. I would figure these guys would be the masters of being able to do this sort of psychokinesis, to have this nirvana, this zone, this in the head. And yet, through all the studies that I've done amateurly and as a history student and among other fellow historians, there's just no correlation between their prowess of the mind and dominating the body and them being able to do psychokinesis. So what do you have to say about that?
Well, you know, in China, I've been working with a Chinese researcher, and they often talk about using qi actually outside the body. And this is not necessarily the Shaolin, but it's other people who, and I've met other martial artists who supposedly could throw qi energy and affect things at a distance. And in fact, when in my very first job at in parapsychology was working at the American Society for Psychical Research, and we had a martial artist come in from Ohio who was trained by a Shaolin a monk actually years before, and he was able to to break a photoelectric beam from the other side of the room by just simply making a motion and throwing qi, and also do some other physical things as well outside his body. And this was on top of all the physical things he could do. He ended up actually being one of the people who taught the men who stare at ghosts, as it turned out. And he also taught some Delta Force guys and some other are the Army Rangers and other folks to do some pretty amazing things, which I've seen on video. I have to say that many martial artists have really interesting things going on. My dad was a producer for NBC Sports, and when I was much younger, I got to see a film of someone breaking a brick, some brick surface, actually it was multi-layers, with their hand, which is, you know, something that martial artists can do, but it was shot at 1,000 frames per second, and I've seen it talked about in other places as well, and the film did exist at NBC, at least during the 70s, early 70s, and you see the stone breaking before the hand actually hits it.
Oh, that's fascinating, actually. Thank you very much for that answer.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me on, Art.
All right.
And, much obliged. Excellent talk tonight. Thanks, guys.
Right, thank you. You know, and yeah, he was the second caller referring to the East, the other caller from Bangkok. Why is it, Lloyd, that people actually, you know what, we're going to go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, if you wouldn't mind, I want to talk about that. Why people in other parts of the world, I've spent a great deal of time myself in the Far East, and they have extremely different attitudes about the kinds of things that we're talking about tonight. Maybe we get on that when we get back. Stay right where you are. You're listening to Midnight in the Desert. My guest is Lloyd Auerbach, And here's kind of a chilling wormhole message. It's from Raymond, and he says, I was told by a priest that if you code and your brain shows no activity when you return and you remember being surrounded by darkness and silence, then you have reached the true hell. Imagine being in nothing forever, no stimulus at all, no sound, and conscious of the fact. Lloyd?
Yeah, that's actually also similar to a description of the Bardo, which is the in-between place that Tibetans and other people talk about before you get reincarnated.
Yes. Oh, that is strange stuff. So anyway, back to other parts of the world, and it certainly is true. In the East, there's an entirely different attitude about spirits and so forth.
Well, in different countries, you know, you go to Australia and look at the beliefs of the Aborigines about psychic abilities.
Sure.
If you go to South America, you have a completely different view of spirits, even amongst the Catholics in Brazil. And Brazil is the most populated Catholic country, where almost every other person is a medium, spirit medium as well. So, yeah, it's cultural traditions, it's religion is different. You know, there is a difference in psychology. People always often talk about East-West psychology. There's a difference in history. And we tend to be a little bit more on the, you know, strict, probably since the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution, the strict materialist reductionist belief system, which is fortunately getting hammered away by some people.
Well, why such differences? I guess just cultural differences, right?
Yeah, there are cultural differences. There, you know, there's a long history in parts of the world for the way that they believe in certain things.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly far more acceptance in the East than here in the West, and I guess it's just pretty much religion-based. I don't know. Anne, you're on the air on Skype. Hi.
Hi. I was calling about something that you had said about the early on the broadcast about people remembering and not being able to remember their near-death experiences.
Right.
And I wanted to throw in, there was a drug called Versed that is given to most surgery patients, and I wondered how many people actually had near-death experiences and didn't remember it because they were given that drug.
That's an interesting question. I don't know of any research on that. It doesn't. The drug itself doesn't sound familiar to me, but that's something that would be very interesting to look into. You know, of course, people have near-death experiences also out when they're in crisis outside the hospital too. And then some people have they're declared dead by paramedics or other folks. Of course, they're not checking their brain activity at that point, but they certainly code it in other ways, and they don't have the near-death experience when they're resuscitated. So it may be related to the drug, and it may not be, but it'd be interesting to look into that, certainly.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Anything else, Anne?
No, that was it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay, let me bring up a subject with you that you may or may not wish to talk about, and that is drugs. There are drugs, Lloyd, that are well documented in producing, what's the right word? You know, I hesitate to even say hallucinations, but they allow self-examination in a strange way. You know, the DMTs, the right. Those types of things. And I wonder if, as part of your examination of the paranormal, if you have looked into any of this.
You know, the drug thing, certainly folks in my field have done that. Certainly we're doing that when it was okay to do so. Andrew Vuharic, who wrote the book The Sacred Mushroom back so long ago, was doing research in telepathy using the psilocybin mushroom,
right,
in very small amounts. Some of the researchers were using LSD before it was illegal, and I know there have been some other experiments done, perhaps maybe on the side with marijuana and some other things. Parapsychology is incredibly underfunded. So trying to do a drug trial or something with drugs today requires incredible oversight at any university or any laboratory these days.
Sure.
And there's just no money to do it. So we have to go on the secondhand or even firsthand observations, anecdotal stories that people tell us of when they have these experiences. And it seems that it's not just drugs, foodstuffs. You know, food is a drug.
Sure.
And you can play with food and have people's states of consciousness affected. And we do know that changing a person's state of consciousness can make them more or less psychic, depending on the person and the state of consciousness they go into. The biggest problem with hallucinogens is being able to separate the psychic imagery from the hallucinatory imagery.
Yes, I guess the big question is whether there even is truly a separation, and it may
be.
There may not be. It may be that it actually does open doors. I don't want to encourage anybody to experiment with drugs, but it may be.
One of the effects that's reported with hallucinogens is synesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
That people will suddenly see the music in color.
That's right.
As it's playing.
That's right.
It's a switching of sensory input and perception. That's what synesthesia is. And there is now some study going on. My colleague Ed May, actually, with his colleague in India, Sonali Marwaha, and Christine Simmons Moore at the University of West Georgia, are all doing research on synesthesia, and that people with some degree of synesthesia may actually be psychic. That may be an indicator of psychic ability. As it turns out, Joe McMonagle, who was viewer number one for the Stargate program, for the
right.
U.S. Army remote viewing program, and Angela Ford, who wasn't designated as number two but was one of the better viewers, are both synesthetes. But they have both some degree of synesthesia. About 4% of the population has synesthesia to some degree or another. And right now there's some plan to get some research money to look into this question and also to do some genetic testing on the people who have shown that they have these abilities and see if you can identify genetically the synesthesia connection to this, too.
By the way, Joe McMonagle, I don't know if you know this or not. I'm sure you very well must, but he had an NDE. He definitely flatlined, and oh, what a story.
Yeah.
What a story he tells.
Well, his story is actually in ESP Wars, because Joe is one of our major contributors to the book.
Uh-huh.
As it happens. And so his full story of his NDEs, he actually had a couple of them, his are in this book. I'm in contact with Joe every now and then. Of course, Ed May is in touch with him and still does research with him. They still do remote viewing research.
Well, we were doing a show on remote viewing, and we somehow stumbled into the NDE that he had, and he began mm-hmm. to tell that story, and oh my God, that
amazing,
was some serious NDE. Yes, yes, yes,
yeah.
Very.
Yeah.
And I only got part of it. I need to get him back, and I need to hear that story in detail because it's really something.
Yeah, it is. It's an amazing story, and again, you'll find it. You've got a copy of the book, Art, so it's in there.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Hold tight right where you are. We've got our last break coming up, and then we will continue to take your calls. You still can get a call in.
Dark Matter News. I'm Leo Ashcraft. Our newest staff writer and comedic artist, Ryan Cook, brings us our next article and a super comic book page titled Man Eaters of the Himalayas. Excellently done. You should check this out on our website at darkmatternews.com. Would you expect a fuzzy kitty to have a body count greater than the likes of Freddy, Jason, and Leatherface combined? The infamous Pinar leopard is one of the several big cats throughout history who made bloody names for themselves by picking off Hindu pilgrims traveling the winding, isolated roads of the Himalayas. During attacks, the leopards lunge for the throat or nape of the neck, aiming to sever as many veins as possible. Homicide skeletons found in Africa and dating back to millions of years are said to show puncture marks from leopard teeth. As human settlement swells into previously wild areas, will the number of attacks increase? These cases are certainly shock to any armchair outdoorsman thinking they are at the top of the food chain. Did you know that back in 2012 there were rumors going around that the Large Hadron Collider machine at CERN managed to open a portal?
This is obviously according to a rumor, but it has been said that the LHC machine managed to open up a doorway to another dimension where giants, known as Nephilim, were witnessed, leading to the machine to be shut down immediately, apparently to be revised and reset for late September 2015. There are many doomsday theories going around these days, stating that the end of the world is coming late September. Of course, we're skeptical like the rest of you, and we've lived to survive another day, though many D-Day theories have come and gone. But one thing is for sure and is happening towards the end of September 2015. The LHC machine at CERN is being fired up again, and reality is that the scientists at CERN are indeed looking to discover a parallel universe. The scientists at CERN have admitted the risks of hunting for extra dimensions and have confirmed that part of the universe we live in could possibly lead into a parallel universe if discovered. Got news tips or other information you'd like to share? Hit the tip line at darkmatternews.com. A story has been making the rounds on the web as of late discussing what is being called the alternative. It refers to a less-than-lethal attachment for law enforcement and government officials that can be placed on the muzzle of a semi-automatic pistol without interfering with the pistol's sights or underbarrel rail, and acts to reduce the velocity of a standard round to make it less lethal. Developed by Alternative Ballistics in California, they claim it comes in a belt-clippable pouch designed to offer one-handed access of the attachment as well as one-handed securing to the pistol itself, all without taking your eyes off of a suspect. The attachment catches a live bullet fired from a gun, and like an airbag for a bullet, it slows the round down to one-fifth of the speed while retaining the blunt impact force to knock a suspect down, effectively lessening the lethal potential of the fired bullet. It's a one-use piece of equipment, allowing for near-instant release from a pistol's muzzle to both allow for immediate follow-up of a lethal round if necessary, while allowing the majority of the attachment itself to be saved for future use. The alternative's first real-world application, as reported by the Washington Post, was actually during the Ferguson riots earlier this year. The city's assistant police chief said it gives another option. You're always looking to save a life, not to take a life. Alternative Ballistics said this technology represents a critical missing link between lethal force and less lethal force. I'm Leo Ashcraft, Dark Matter News.
From Tim through the wormhole, Tim says, Art, what's the chance that a shadow person may be a remote viewer? I had heard this is a possibility. God, that's awful to even imagine for me. Could a shadow person, could that be, Lloyd?
Well, that would fall into the idea of bilocation and out-of-body experience, which is different experientially for people, certainly,
yes.
And remote viewing. Remote viewing, they're fully aware and they're in the location. They don't actually go. They don't even send their mind to the location. They just get information from the location.
Okay. I guess. I mean, we think we know that, right? There aren't so few absolutes.
Well, that certainly is the experience of remote viewers. There are instances where people, we did out-of-body experience research with a guy named Alex Tanis, a very talented psychic and researcher and teacher back at the American Society for Psychical Research. I was marginally on the outside of that research when I was working there. I actually put up a video about that experiment, in fact, on my YouTube channel. If you just go to YouTube and look for ASPR OBE experiment, you can find it. And Alex had experiences where he had an out-of-body experience, traveled in his out-of-body state, he reported, and was seen at the other end, kind of.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, those kinds of experiences go back hundreds of years, actually. We have crisis apparitions where people are in crisis and they seem to project themselves to loved ones to try to get help. And apparitions of living people from time to time, when people are having an out-of-body experience in their dreams, they can sometimes be seen as ghosts. So it's possible that some of the shadow people, I wouldn't say remote viewers, but there might be somebody.
That's disturbing to me. Because the whole shadow person thing just absolutely, I'm going to be honest, it scared the hell out of me. It really did.
Yeah, and you know, there's that group of shadow people that apparently wear fedora hats or something.
Oh, yeah, I know. I've
you know,
seen
there's it's one of those phenomena that we're not really sure, and frankly, in parapsychology, we only touch them. First of all, they don't get reported to us that often, and when we look into them, you know, they tend to be in the ghost. The ones at work seem to be in the ghostly category.
Of all the things that I would have, a shadow person, your shadow person, Wheeling, Illinois, I think it is. Hello.
Yes. Good to finally get on. I have a question about near-death experiences.
Yes.
I've always been fascinated by this, but my problem with it, and truly believing it, is if we do believe that there is a God, and I do myself, I'm a believer, Art. Why would he show us a glimpse of the afterlife, and why would he show some people a glimpse of the afterlife and not others? Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's a heck of a good question, Lloyd.
You know, God's supposed to be unknowable, so I couldn't answer that question.
Well done. Because that's a tough question. I mean, if
how we're human. If there is a God, who are we to presume we know the mind of God?
Well done. I have no response to that.
Yeah, I just, you know, that's...
But really, it is a pretty good question. Some people have these experiences, and then other people, nothing. I would hate to think that the person who sent the wormhole message is correct.
Well, you know, some people die on the operating table.
They do.
So we don't know whether they may have had those experiences. The people who do have these near-death experiences sometimes say that there is a person there. And, you know, there have been cross-cultural studies, by the way. Some people meet relatives. Some people meet religious figures. And it's based on the religion that you are. So in a cross-cultural study done by Carlos Osis and Earl Arnder Haraldson years ago, looking at Christians in the U.S. with near-death experiences and Hindus in India, the Christians tended to see either relatives or saints or Jesus or Christian figures. The Hindus saw Hindu gods.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on there?
I have no idea. That's an honest answer. All right, up to Bozeman, Montana. Hello.
Hi, Art. Wow, I actually managed to get you.
You did.
First off, Manny Roswell, so many. I've been listening to you since I was 5 years old back in the 80s.
And you're 80 now, right?
Yes, that's it.
Yeah, I'm kidding.
I'm really glad that you're back on the air.
Thank you.
100%.
Thank you.
Lloyd, I was wondering what your thoughts on the possibility of all this PK activity being quantum in nature. Just thinking about quantum entanglement and quantum physics, anything that you're close to, you might be able to affect with your mind just due to the very nature of particles.
Well, you know, if we want to speculate from a science fiction perspective, we could possibly scale it up from the quantum level to the macro level. The biggest problem we've got is this scaling up. You know, a big thing moves. Now, of course, that big thing, a chair or even a ball, is made up of quantum particles, and we might affect them. We'd have to affect them all, I guess, and maybe even affect gravity. Maybe we're affecting gravity.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just, you know, thinking about at some point if you'd be able to find a way to look at particles, that people move particles, is that much had to be easier than, you know, moving bigger things.
Good point.
Yeah,
actually,
it's a really good point. And we're just, I think we're still scratching the surface in physics of a lot of what's going on in the quantum world and how it scales up, or does it even scale up.
And there is, I get something called Science News, Lloyd, and there is something very interesting going on with quantum entanglement. They're determining that there is a way, perhaps, to use the entanglement aspect to communicate, to actually transmit information. They're right on the edge of this. I knew this was coming. I knew it had to come.
I knew it, too. And of course, science fiction writers always talk about the Ansible, which is basically on that principle. So, you know, it's got to be coming. It's spooky action at a distance.
Big
cool
one. Speaking of distances, Andy Jazz, it is down in Australia. Hello.
Hey, Art, how are you?
I'm very well indeed, thank you.
That's good. I just wanted to know if Lloyd has had any experience with the phenomena of streetlights turning off or on as you drive by. Is this a phenomena, or is it just a case of you only noticing the few times that it does happen and not probably the million times that it doesn't? Similar to the 11-11 phenomena.
Right. Also known as streetlight interference, or SLI, for folks in my field. Well, you know, we'd have to take each individual streetlight incident separately, because some streetlights do have photoelectric eye cells that, when a light beam hits them, as if the sun hitting them, they can turn off. So a car driving by can reflect off something, can cause that to snap off. But that said, I've seen a few people. We've had a few people over the years who have been said that they could turn off streetlights, and walking by on a quiet street, as they walk by the streetlights turned out. So that was pretty cool to see that happen. And of course, then you do have times that streetlights do cycle on and off. So it may just be that some of the streetlights that were even turning off for this guy could have been because of the cycle that was happening. But he seemed to be able to actually, his presence seemed to affect things in that way.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Great show, guys.
Thank you, Jazz. Take care.
You know, I should mention, Art, I'm trained as a magician and mentalist also.
Really?
So it's kind of my parallel career, and it served me really well, not because I think people are typically lying or faking, but because we do perceive things in unusual, mysterious ways, and that's how magicians and mentalists can make people think things are happening. And so when we do investigations of people's experiences outside the laboratory where it's not controlled, we always have to look for alternative explanations, and sometimes you find multiple alternative explanations, and until you can rule them out, you don't really have psychic things happening.
Okay, sure. Let's try George out there somewhere. George, where are you?
I'm about 40 kilometers north of Hamburg, Germany.
Wow, okay.
Little farming village.
Alrighty.
I had an experience at 5 years old. I'm an American, by the way. I had my tonsils taken out.
Oh, yes.
And I always had a problem as a kid of sleeping or going to sleep easily. So, and at that time they used, I'm not sure, gas or something to put you out.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And when they put me out, I died on the table. And I didn't find this out until years later from my mother, that I had actually, and it was just for a very short time, like 20, 30 seconds. And, but I distinctly remember, and remember it today, floating and noticing that my gown that I in, I could see the color of it, the slight blue. Rather than seeing a bright light or a tunnel, I had like an illuminated screen in front of me.
Wow.
And I'm floating, and the screen was white. Everything else around me was kind of a gray, and I could hear them talking. The physician was my uncle. And I know they were concerned, and I was telling him, I'm right here. Everything's okay. I'm fine. And next thing I know, I woke up in the bed, but I had no bed in the hospital, back in my room after the operation.
Boy, this sounds like a very, very strongly imprinted memory.
Yes, yeah. Very strong. I'll never forget this. It's just like it was yesterday. And I'm 65, so that was 60 years ago.
Right. The effects, actually, of the gas they used back then, very weird. I had some, too. Nothing like you had, and I certainly died on nobody's table. But that's really something. NDEs absolutely fascinate me. George, I can't tell you enough how much I appreciate your call. Any comment, Lloyd?
Well, you know, people, there are different images than the traditional tunnel and light. When I was over in Japan a number of years ago, I talked to a number of people. I was doing a show on near-death experiences and talked to a number of people who didn't see, they had near-death experiences. They had all the classic effects post the experience and biologically had the effects, but they were crossing a bridge. They crossed a bridge. There was no tunnel. There was a bridge. And then there was a rose garden, a flower garden, in a sunny day, and that's where they met their ancestor who told them it wasn't their time and sent them back. And we see this in different parts, and you're talking about East-West psychology here. It seems like in China and Japan, I've talked to people from the Chinese community here in the Bay Area, and they too have, who have had near-death experiences, did not experience the tunnel effect, which kind of contradicts some of the explanations that neurobiologists have come up with for what a near-death experience is. And it's always interesting that he remembers it so vividly is an earmark of a true NDE. That kind of imprinting and effect is absolutely an earmark of it.
There you go, George.
Yeah, that's kind of frightening. Yeah, right. It was like a movie screen lit up white, and I could see this screen, but I couldn't see them. And I had no one come and tell me that it wasn't my time to go. I don't think I realized that I was dead.
Maybe you weren't gone long enough for that. I really appreciate the call, George, all the way from Germany. Thank you. We're developing this very international audience. Let's go to Denver. You're on the air with Lloyd.
Hey, Art. This is Matt, your undefeated atheist from Friday night, part of the
5-0, Matt.
5-0, part of the DM talk. Hashtag over at Twitter. But I got a real quick question. I know you're almost out of time.
I know you up. I saw you up there celebrating again and again, Matt.
Oh, I had to. That's what you got to do. You got to celebrate your victories.
Okay. Anyway.
All right. So real quick, I had a question. It was about his experiences where he said that he witnessed in a controlled environment, you know, the spoon bending and the pencil rolling. Mm-hmm. My question is, and I know you have a problem with funding, that if you've proven this in, you know, like a vacuum kind of a scientific kind of element, why not take this to the $1 million skeptic or $1 million paranormal challenge, make the $1 million, prove it, legitimize it, and make grant money, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would encourage you to go to Randy's site, to randy.org, and actually read the application process and the rules. And you'll see why no one actually takes that research there.
I've seen people go on his things, but he only seems to get, you know, kind of the kooky people. The
yeah,
people who are legitimate claim
people
they want
really,
to go on it.
Yeah, people who really look at the rules and look at the challenge, it's not about whether they can do it or not. It's about who owns the rights to what.
It gives up patent rights or your...
There's so many things. First of all, there's a lot of hurdles because... and frankly, it's just not—it's not going to be set up fairly. The test itself may be fair, the controls, but people who have gone through or gotten up to that, there have been enough changes and tweaks to the challenge over the years. It's really about the rules, and if you really read the rules, and then also you might read an analysis of it on the Daily Grail, Greg Taylor's blog. He did a really great study of the $1 million challenge a few years ago. And it's just not, it's not something that an athlete's manager, a professional athlete, would not be allowed by his manager to take the challenge if it was a challenge for athletic performance.
Okay, I can see on that. I just love that, you know, Randy, when he was on Carson and Yuri Geller and Peter Popoff were on there and he didn't expect them to be on there. And he kind of showed him how the spoon bending worked. And you even said,
"Oh, you can fake it. You can fake any of this stuff. Are you kidding?" You know, and the spoon bending—I have to say—the spoon bending has not been done under controlled conditions. But there have been analyses of the spoons after they've been bent, and there's some interesting things that are going on there. The fact is that you can fake any of this stuff.
All right, Matt, I'm going to have to go. Yeah. Show is ending.
Hey, thanks, Art.
You bet. Take care, buddy. And. Boy, Lloyd, what a show. Thank you so very much. Your book is ESP Wars, and it is out now, right?
I've got a couple of online courses coming up if people want to check those out, too.
So online courses as well. Okay.
Yep. And those, if they go to the Rhine Center site, which is rhine.org, They can click on education, the Education Center, and find out about the courses.
Well, it has been an astoundingly good show. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Have a good night. Bye-bye. That's Lloyd Auerbach. Very, very good guest. We probably touched on just about everything, I think, and a little beyond. So, tomorrow night, I kind of gave it away. Unless I'm wrong, I believe it is Shadow People, and it's going to be a very unsettling show for me in view of what's happened recently. But unsettling, that's what we do. Good night, all.
Desert.